Drew Peach.
Thanks, Sarah. Good afternoon. Lebanon's Prime Minister has said the ongoing Israeli attacks could displace as many as a million people in the country. Najib Mikati said a diplomatic solution to the crisis was now the only option. He was speaking as the Israeli military continued to bombard targets in Lebanon after killing Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah on Friday. At least 15 people are reported to have been killed in the latest attacks. The Cabinet Office Minister Pat McFadden has rejected a claim from the former Labour MP Rosie Duffield that the lads are in charge in Downing Street. Ms Duffield said the party quit the party last night over a number of issues, including the government's decision to restrict winter fuel payments to pensioners and the gifts given to Sir Keir Starmer by the party donor Lord Ali. Mr McFadden said he was disappointed at her decision, but added she'd been disillusioned with the party for quite a long time. At the start of the Conservative conference in Birmingham, Kemi Badenoch has defended comments she made in a Sunday Telegraph article, claiming that not all cultures are valid. The Conservative leadership candidate refused to name any specific groups, but told the BBC it was clear to her that many people who've recently arrived in the country have brought views that have no place here. The authorities in Nepal say more than 120 people are now known to have been killed in floods and landslides triggered by the heaviest rain in over half a century. More than 60 people are still missing, with rescue operations ongoing. Pope Francis has presided over Mass in Brussels at the end of a trip to Belgium, where he's faced unusual levels of direct criticism. During the three-day visit, the Pope was repeatedly challenged about child sexual abuse scandals in the Catholic Church. Belgium's King and Prime Minister said the Vatican had been too slow to act. Voting's taking place in Austria in a general election that could see the far-right Freedom Party win the most seats for the first time. The party crashed out of a coalition government with the Conservative People's Party 5 years ago because of a corruption scandal. On to the weather. Strong to near gale force winds and heavy rain developing in the South West and South Wales later. It'll be dry in Northern Ireland, Scotland and the north of England. High temperatures of 19 Celsius in London, 17 in Cardiff and Belfast and 14 degrees in Edinburgh. That's the BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past 12. Now, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The actor Lucien Umsumati has played leading roles on our most famous stages. Salieri in Peter Schaffer's Amadeus at the National Theatre, Iago in Othello at the Royal Shakespeare Company, Estragon opposite Ben Whishaw in Waiting for Godot at the Theatre Royal Haymarket in London. But he started out performing, in his words, for farmers sitting on beer crates in rural Africa with tables for a stage. And when he decided to build a career in the UK, he worked as a cleaner to pay the bills. Well, his perseverance paid off. You've perhaps seen him in high-profile television shows like Game of Thrones and the number one ladies' detective agency. Lucien, after your success in Amadeus, it's no surprise to find Mozart among your choices today. But we've also got Chopin, Tchaikovsky, Benjamin Clementine. But we're starting with Sarti. Why this?
Well, first of all, may I say, that is an amazing intro, sir. I feel about 10,000 feet taller than I actually am.
Well, that's very nice. This is to calm you down. This is a very calming piece of music, isn't it?
It's an incredibly calming piece of music. I think of the world after rain. I don't know what it is about this piece of music that for me paints pictures of leaves with glistening silver, drops of water, the evaporation, the mist in the air. And growing up in Zimbabwe, there's such a distinct smell after the rain and before the rain. It's this hot, metallic granite smell that is earthed, that makes you feel both bigger and smaller. But I'm also blown away by just how modern this piece is. It could have been written yesterday. It never fails to uplift me and to send me to that special dreamy place.
Gymnopédie, composed by Erik Satie, performed by Joanna McGregor. And it occurred to me as I was listening, Lucien, that quality of sometimes less is more must be one that you embrace quite often in the theatre.
Yes, because when it comes down to it, communication, to reach and to touch, vulnerability is to remove yourself from any pretense, to remove yourself from any intellectual fashioning and sit in the truth. And the truth can be a beautiful, uncomfortable, inspirational, enlightening thing if you allow it. When it comes down to it, you just have to say the words as they are on the page. I remember watching a documentary in which the Oscar-winning actor Jamie Foxx met the legend that is Ray Charles. The one message that the great man had for the actor-musician who was to play him was, play the notes under your finger. And it's something that I hold fast to this day.
Not get in the way of the composer or the playwright.
Absolutely.
You were born in the UK, Lucien, but grew up in Zimbabwe, which had only become an independent country in 1980. You lived in Harare, and I wondered what it was like there in the early 80s.
Oh, well, my memory of it was of a beautiful and abundant place, like a paradise, a fantasy land for a young child. But I also remember, strangely, the smell of pine trees. Now, Zimbabwe is one of the most beautiful, naturally beautiful countries you will ever have the pleasure and privilege to visit. Nature is everywhere.
So, Lucien, your dad was a doctor,
yes.
Your mum was a nurse.
That is right. My late father was an anatomist and an histologist, quite a respected one, who in his later years was inducted into the Tanzania Academy of Sciences.
Your parents came from there, didn't they?
Yes. And actually, part of his induction was to write a short autobiography. And he never spoke much about his mother. But in this short autobiography, he spoke of how close he was to her, how much he loved her, and how very quickly he remembers her deteriorating. He was very, very young. And she says to him, you know, I'm leaving you now, Alakwe. And Alakwe is a word in the Makua language that means loved one or beloved one. And he decided, so he tells us, that he would become a doctor because he wanted to find out what had happened to his mother. And he worked out years later that it was cervical cancer. Yeah, so that's, it was quite a man. Quite a man, yes. Sorry, I'm getting choked up thinking about him. Mm. But yeah, that is who he is for us.
Was there music in your family when you were young?
We were surrounded by music. I remember there being lots of fun, lots of singing along, lots of dance moves practiced to various music videos. My late father, God rest his soul, fancied himself a bit of a DJ in his younger days. He was the life and soul of the party. But perhaps I came to an appreciation of what would be considered classical music a little later.
So you didn't learn an instrument when you were young?
Now, I tried to learn an instrument. I failed spectacularly. I've basically been trying to be Stevie Wonder since I was about 7 years old. And maybe one day, when I'm grown up and patient enough, I'll actually sit down and learn a few things on the piano. There is, of course, a musicality, I think, that exists in the works of the great writers. I think, you know, before any of us actually had words, we have sound. I'm going to claim that we're all made of music. It's just that some are more advanced in their journey than others. So in my heart, I'm saying it here now, I'm actually a world-class pianist, harmonica player, trombonist, and bass guitarist. So there.
Well, you have actually got a world-class pianist in your next music, Yevgeny Kissin, because it's the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto. Where did you first hear this? Can you remember?
This was Christmas 1995 or Christmas 1996. Now, I remember this because it was the Christmas that my maternal grandfather passed. And at the time, both my mother and my late father had to travel back to Tanzania. So we four kids spent Christmas Day with very, very dear family friends. And when after two movies had been viewed, we heard the dreaded words, okay, it's time to switch off the video now. My heart sank. I slumped back and I thought, dear Lord, how am I going to survive however many remaining hours there are of this utterly dull Christmas Day? And at that point, my uncle walked in And he said, would you like to listen to some music? And I said, yeah, okay, thinking that I was going to have a run of all the latest, coolest, hottest things, or at least the old people's version of it, as I thought of. And he said to me, have you heard Tchaikovsky? He put the tape in, pressed play, and I went on this sonic excursion. I was absolutely blown away.
Thank you.
the opening of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, performed by Yevgeny Kissin and the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. You've certainly got that wonderful Russian romantic feeling there.
Completely. The melancholy, the agony and the ecstasy. There's nothing quite like it. That ache that we long for but can't stand, but keep going back to.
While you were at school, you and your friends, Lucien, actually set up a theatre company, Over the Edge.
We did indeed. We all clicked and connected and wanted to spread our own wings, tell our own stories. But that effectively was my drama school. I learnt my craft by doing. When you pursue something with the eyes and the ears and the heart of an enthusiast, a world of joy is open to you. I think it doesn't put any limits on your curiosity or your ability to fail and to fail better and to enjoy your failure and to dive into it and learn from it. You know, every single mistake I've ever made as an actor, every single lesson I've ever learned has been in front of paying audiences. So, you know, I thank Over the Edge for that.
And did you feel at that point, this is for me, this is the world that I love?
Well, according to my mother, I was 3 years old when I declared that I wanted to be an actor. So I think it was inevitable.
And how were they received, these over-the-edge performances? Did they go down well?
Well, initially, they went down a storm. You know, we were a young, multiracial company who was telling stories of our life, of the reality that was around us. We caused a lot of stir with our political satires. So you'd have people roaring with laughter on one hand and then gasping, looking over their shoulders, wondering when the Central Intelligence Organization officers were going to come and round us up. So for us, being able to tell our own stories, I think this was the greatest lesson of all. Our new African, young African stories were as legitimate, as complex, and as valuable as any other, as well as the Shakespeares, the Wallace Soyinkas, the Arthur Millers.
You took part yourself in demonstrations against the Mugabe government. I rather wonder what that must have been like, and must have been quite frightening at times.
I mean, you're really taking me back, Michael. My generation of Zimbabweans really had the very best of the country. We really were the golden generation, if you like. And we witnessed its deterioration and decline. But we also witnessed the growing, burgeoning voice of an active and vocal and educated opposition. But when you grow up in a culturally conservative and effectively a one-party state nation, dissent is not encouraged, shall we say. And so, yes, that aspect of it was quite frightening. Although, to be fair, I think by the time we sort of found our voices, we were probably preaching to the converted. But yes, to find one's voice, stand up, to express what is going on, I think is an artistic duty and responsibility and delight, because you do get to see everything. I often misquote the late, great Miriam Makeba, a great South African singer, who, when she was asked whether her music was political, said, "I sing about what happens and what I see every day and every night in my country. And if you choose to see that as political, there ain't a damn thing I can do about it." So I hold fast to that.
Tell me about Nakazonga.
Ah, Nakazonga. Lokwa Kanza is one of the great contemporary Congolese musicians. And Nakazonga, in the language of Lingala, means come back, to return, come home. Earlier we were talking about simplicity, cutting to the chase, getting to the essence of something. And for me, this man's amazing voice, the musicality, but also the purity of the message that is a lot more sophisticated than just a plea. There is heartache within this beautiful call to say, come back when you're ready, come back, you always have a home here. But this never fails to move me. You know, I believe the man has got the voice truly of an angel. So sit back, relax, and come back, as the Lingala would say. Mama,
Kabamboka musika tokende koluka bomoima tokoma mitelengano na mboka mopaya nani ya sunga yo pasi na pasi e
nakei kasi lobi na kozonga
atandele o
mopembo ezali ndeli
wateo
nakei
Oyanga bako yambanga
Mbembo, ezali ndeli wateo
Akozonga mboka
Akei, kasi lobi na
kozonga Ayeba yama
Mbembo, ezali ndeli wateo
Atandeleo, tokozonga Kinshasa Pasyo yo elekie ninyo kolo Kaya mupaya pasi baninga Atandele toko zonga kinshasa o Pempeni abayeba ndakayo Atandele toko zonga mboka o Mboka babo tabiso Atandele
Takei kasi lobi na kozonga
na kozonga
mopembo ezali ndeli
wate ogo baninga
kasi lobi na kozonga
ezali seloko ya ngonga
mopembo ezali ndeli wate
lobi tokozonga mboka
kasi lobi na kozonga
lobi tokozonga
mopembo
Lobi na kozonga
Mopembo
Ezali ndeli wateo
Nakei
Kasi lobi na kozonga Kinshasa mame
Mopembo
Ezali ndeli wateo
Nakei Kasi lobi na kozonga Mopembo Ezali ndeli wateo Nakei Kasi lobi na kozonga
Gets those feet tapping, doesn't it?
It really does. What a treat. What a delight. What a balm for the soul.
Nakozonga, composed and performed by Lokwa Kanza. Lucien Umsamati, in 2001, you decided to leave Zimbabwe. Was that a difficult decision?
On one hand, yes. On another hand, no. The political upheaval, the economic shifts were making it increasingly impossible for the likes of myself to carry on pursuing our passions. I think it is also fair to say that at quite a young age, we had already achieved quite a lot. There were greener pastures to pursue, and, you know, very often those around us would say, what are you doing here? Off you go, go on.
All actors have to cope with rejection to a point, but actually your roles came pretty thick and fast, didn't they?
After years and years and years of rejection.
Well, there you are. I thought we might mention that.
There were quite a few years of hard, thankless, but necessary slog. Whenever I have the chance to speak to those who are up and coming, I always say that, look, first of all, we don't get paid enough to have a bad time. And secondly, you really, truly and honestly have to love it. You can't just like it. You've got to love it. Because you will suffer rejection a lot. In fact, that's probably going to be most of your life as a professional. regardless of your talent.
I can't think of a greater euphemism than resting.
Exactly. But in time, you learn that actually this resting time, rejection, is part of life. The chance to experience other walks of life, to do other things, to be a part of the life that we endeavour to portray in the stories that we tell. That's a gift.
Lucian, critics are part of every actor's life, and I wonder how much you care about what they say.
It's taken me a very long time, Michael. This is the absolute truth. Other than work that I have directed or produced where I have a professional duty of care to the cast or to the production or to the investors, I have not read a review of anything that I've been in on stage for about 11 or 12 years now. And it all started at the RSC with Pericles, my first big leading role. This is in the days of the Internet Cafe. After our very lovely press night, I decided, let me go down to the Internet Cafe and see what they've written about us. This must be the great beginning of my glorious, storied career. And the first review I found was scathing of me in particular. It absolutely tore the bleep, bleep, bleep out of everything I did. I walked out shaking, and I remember standing on the pavement thinking, this is it. I've had a good run of things. Maybe I should go back to being an advertising copywriter. But then this huge wave of anger then came over me, and I remember this voice in me going, how dare they? Who do they think they are? I'll show them. And thus began this appreciation that, look, you're never going to please everybody. You are never going to be to everybody's tastes. If you cannot walk into something with your own critical faculties, with your own compassion and grace and self-knowledge, with the understanding that this is going to be a journey, you are not going to be uplifted by the words of someone else. And you're not going to be torn down by the words of someone else. I decided that all that matters is the applause at the end of the night. And it was a process. It took me a long time to wean myself off of reading the reviews. And it got to a point where I would say to cast members, I don't want to hear anything. I don't want to know. Don't tell me. And I'm all the better for it.
The next piece is one of my favourites, the Sibelius Seventh Symphony. But what does it mean to you?
This is a shameless plug and a dedication to my great friend and work colleague, the brilliant actor, Mr. Tom Eden, who is oozing green with envy over the fact that I am on this program before he is. Other than being an amazing actor and a brilliant cartoonist, his next great love is classical music. And Tom's knowledge, it's beyond encyclopedic. And I look forward to the day when I can listen to him telling you all about this particular piece.
we heard part of Sibelius' Symphony No. 7 in C major, performed by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by John Stogalis. Lucien Umsomati, one of your first major TV roles was in the No. 1 Ladies Detective Agency, written by Alexander McCall Smith. The character you play owns the Speedy Motors garage?
That is correct. The one and only Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni, who goes on to become the love interest of the great Ma Ramotswe, played in our version by the one and only Jill Scott.
He's quite a perfectionist, isn't he?
Yes, he is. That's amongst his many qualities. But he's a decent man. Let's just say he perhaps had forgotten his way around the ladies, but he very quickly gets a schooling and returns to the great world of romance.
It was filmed in Botswana and directed by Anthony Minghella, and I wonder what that was like.
Well, one of the modern greats, a true privilege. You would not have met a more calm, a more relaxed, avuncular presence than Anthony, who just had quiet authority about him. He was possessed of this wonderful, gentle steel. Funnily enough, one of the great notes he gave me was after shooting a particular scene, he called me over and he said, "Lucien, you're not serving my writing," at which point my heart fell out of my stomach because I thought, oh, this is it. I'm going to become an anecdote now. And he walked me a little distance away from the set with his arm around me and said, "I rewrote this a few days ago for you. These cadences, the rhythms that the character has, this is all your rhythm. You don't have to work that hard. The work has been done for you." And funnily enough, I suppose it is my equivalent of being told to play the note that is under your finger.
And of course, only 5 days after your show premiered on the BBC in 2008, Anthony Minghella suddenly died due to complications from surgery. That must have been devastating for you, as it was for everybody in the theatre.
It was quite devastating. I remember one of the last conversations I had with him. He said to me, "You know, get ready. Your life is going to change. You're going to get so sick of this show, I'm telling you." Little did we know, of course, what was around the corner, but I will forever hold the great man in very, very high esteem.
And your next piece is from one of his films, The English Patient.
Oh, yes. Not only did I fall in love with the film, I fell deeply, deeply in love with the music, and I remember buying the soundtrack, and me and some friends would listen to it endlessly. And I remember when it won its bucket load of Oscars, I remember watching the ceremony with friends, watching Anthony coming up to receive his numerous awards, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, one day, if it's possible, I would love to be able to work with people of this caliber. Little did I know, a few years down the line, that dream would come true. So this piece of music has a particular beauty and resonance and heartache.
Thank you.
What a beautiful, beautiful piece of music.
The Cave of Swimmers, composed by Gabriel Jarrett and performed by the Academy of St. Martin, conducted by Harry Rabinowitz. Lucien Umsumati, in 2015, you appeared alongside Hugh Quashie in a production of Othello. You're the first black actor to ever play Iago. What was your reaction when this was first suggested?
Well, it was a case of be careful what you wish for, because not many months before, I had been approached by a very prestigious theatre director alongside a very, very respected and much loved actor, and they were very interested in me playing the role of Othello, to which my response was, I'm incredibly flattered, thank you very much, but first of all, Othello isn't my favourite Shakespeare, and secondly, there's only one role that I'm interested in playing, and that is the role of Iago. So unless you're offering me that, I'm not interested. Not many moons later, I got a call from my agent, the wonderful Leslie Duff, who said, be careful what you wish for, because guess what? The RSC, Iqbal Khan, is directing Othello with Hugh Quashie, and they would like you to consider playing the role of Iago.
How, Lucien, did it change the play for you, actually taking part in it?
So there are the obvious questions. There's the obvious lore around who's who in the zoo in Othello. What I was struck by was that actually what is considered a quote-unquote racial reading of it is the least interesting part of it. That actually what I got a sense of was a love story between two comrades at war. One who believes that there is a code of conduct, we have served together, we have seen unspeakable horrors, we have been through it all, and by our code of honor and the system, I should be the next one to step up. But you, being a politician, as in Othello, quite rightly decides that actually, no, when I move amongst the elite and the powerful, I need someone who speaks their language, and that, dear friend, isn't you. It's heartbreaking. It is horrible. But it was also the beginning of me trying to tackle a character whose motivation isn't hate, but actually love. It's far more interesting. It is easy to use words like hate. No, he's going to destroy him because he loves him. But also, what we found was that there were a lot of connections. A lot of things actually made sense, that, you know, that there was a particular camaraderie between Othello and Iago, that Othello would trust Iago more, even though Iago is completely, you know, playing him. So all of these works, these great canonical works, belong to everybody. You cannot say that because it was written by such and such a person at such and such a time, it does not belong to them. It does belong to me. It's part of my education. It's part of my upbringing. When I pull it off the shelf, it is absolutely my right and my responsibility and my delight to tackle it through the prism of my time, of my reality. And that is how, I believe, these great universal stories have withstood the test of time, because we have to interrogate them through the prism of our times. And sometimes it doesn't work. Of course it doesn't. But that's art, isn't it? That's what we do.
Would you now like the chance to play Othello, having been through this?
Nope, not at all.
What Shakespeare roles would you love to take on?
Ooh, I always wanted to play Juliet. Now, that may sound like that's me being ridiculous and facetious. I'm not. As ridiculous as it sounds, for me, the ultimate challenge as an actor is how do I convince the world that me, a barrel-chested, deep-voiced, middle-aged man of African origin, how do I convince you that I'm a headstrong, love-struck 14-year-old girl? That would be a challenge. And it is for that reason that I wish to play Juliet.
Well, I'd love to see that. But you're going to give us something, Lucien, which is also going to be quite surprising for a Radio 3 audience, which is the Ave Maria by Franz Schubert, but not sung by, for example, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau or Elly Ameling. Who have you chosen?
I have chosen the one and only Stevie Wonder. I stumbled across this quite by accident, and when I played it, it really did blow my mind. It is a combination of Schubert and Stevie Wonder, and it's entirely Schubert, and it's entirely Stevie. And it is brilliant. I defy anybody to listen to this and not shed a tear of utter ecstatic delight. It is magical. Long live Stevie, long live Schubert, say I.
Ave Maria, gratia plena, Maria, gratia plena, Maria.
Ave Maria by Franz Schubert, performed by Stevie Wonder. Is it partially the attempt of someone like Stevie Wonder to take on that music that makes it so moving for you?
Well, I would say that it's not even an attempt. I'm a huge Stevie Wonder devotee. He truly is music made manifest, and he is a great student of all musical forms, as all the greats are. And so his audacious attempt in the ears of some is actually the most beautiful tribute and homage. I would love to hear Schubert's version of Isn't She Lovely? Wouldn't that be great? Yes. You know?
Yeah. Lucien, in 2016, you landed the lead role as Salieri in Peter Schaffer's Amadeus at the National Theatre. And for anyone unfamiliar with the story, it's Mozart's genius seen through the eyes of his older rival, Salieri, who can't stand him. What did you particularly love about the part?
Well, I think if we are honest with ourselves, there is someone in our lives who we look at and think, how is it possible that you are able to make everything so effortless and I have to sweat buckets and break every bone in my body just to get the key in the door? We are mystified by them. We are terrified by them. And we loathe them because they expose what we believe to be ordinary within ourselves. And I completely, as a professional artist, identified with that very human sort of dichotomy of devotion, of jealousy, of ambition, of love, all combined into this very wonderful memory play. Because, of course, the Schaffer version of Salieri is a very, very unreliable narrator and, of course, not historically accurate at all. Mm. But why let the truth get in the way of a good story? You know, Salieri was a great supporter of Mozart's, actually. I think the great skill of the playwright was to show us the very true heart of this prodigious, quite messy, quite scatological brat who was blessed by the gods. And so for, you know, a discerning, devoted, by-the-book player like Salieri to have this piece of filth in his eyes as being the one upon whom the creator bestows favor is a terrible thing. And, you know, he comes face to face with the reality of the fact that, well, actually, I don't want to be John the Baptist. I want to be the Christ. And I think a lot of us, if we're honest, would say the same.
Well, you've chosen Mozart's Serenade for wind instruments,
yes,
which appears at a key moment in the drama.
It does indeed.
Remind us what that is.
So this is in the drawing room scene in which Salieri tells us that this was the moment that his life changed. This was the moment that he hears the first piece of Mozart's music that doesn't particularly sound like anything to begin with and then becomes something else. And his moment of realization that I have been touched by God. I have been so moved to the core of my soul that I have been disturbed. This is the thing that I have been searching for, but it has been given to this obscene child. But actually, the real reason I've chosen this is because the magic of being in a rehearsal room is that you get to witness so many undocumented and private firsts. The first time a piece of music is nailed, the first time a scene is nailed, the first time we as a company see a particular moment that has been hidden away. It is a beautiful thing, and I will never forget being in the rehearsal room 2 and a bit weeks in as the orchestra were playing this music, and I got the timing right for the first time. And all of us choked up.
Thank you.
As a composer, Lucien, I have to say to you that I rather share Salieri's sense not only of overwhelming wonder, but also a degree of it's just not fair.
You and me both, sir. You and me both.
The Adagio from Mozart's Serenade for Wind Instruments in B-flat major, performed by the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Now, you're currently playing Estragon, aren't you, opposite Ben Whishaw in Waiting for Godot, a classic play where two men wait anxiously and patiently for a man who never appears. Two people coming to the play who perhaps are concerned about how to approach it, how to get the most out of it, that perhaps are a bit baffled. What would you say to them?
I would say this. We are performing this play in a post-pandemic world, and many of us, the bottom fell out of our lives. Many of us were confined to our homes. Everything that we did, all the people we loved, all our daily routines were taken away from us, and we were left in a void. And in that void, we dealt with a whole lot of things. In that void, a lot of things that perhaps we had swept under the carpet as people, as a nation, came to the fore. And in that void, we sat hoping, waiting, wishing for something that at a certain point never felt like it was going to come. Some of us never got a chance to say goodbye to loved ones. Some of us lost livelihoods. But I believe that in essence, we can all relate to the sitting, the waiting, the hoping, the laughter, the joy, the delight, the terror, and this need for hope in the midst of what is inevitable. Because I think perhaps in other times, our relationship with the end, with death, was a lot healthier. I think in our day and age, somehow we have sanitized this notion of the end comes to us all. You know, death is unbeaten. And sometimes faced with that, it can seem gloomy, it can seem bleak, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it is a call for another direction, a call to sort of sit, laugh, contemplate, and look at life in a different way. And just have a great, weird, wonderful, entertaining night out. Because actually the man himself was nowhere near as weighty or as intellectually burdened as his work has become. In fact, his favorite word is perhaps. It's a great night out, folks. Really it is. You'll have a laugh, you'll have a cry, you'll have a think, and then we'll have a drink afterwards. Hooray!
Which brings us to your next piece of music, doesn't it?
Yes. So my character, Estragon, who has, amongst other things, trouble sleeping and is constantly being disturbed by his old friend Vladimir, who just won't let him rest because Vladimir is afraid of being lonely. When he has one of his, we don't know whether it's a nightmare or whether it's a beautiful dream, all will be revealed. But in the second act, in order to shake Estragon out of his bad dream, Vladimir marches him up and down, whistling the Chopin funeral march. But actually what's revealing is that for a piece that is written in and around death and funerals at the end, it is actually really quite beautiful and uplifting in its own way. You know, there is a surprise in everything if you care to look for it. And that has certainly been the gift for me in getting to know this piece of music more intimately as part of the show. Thank you.
Chopin's Funeral March from the Piano Sonata No. 2 in B-flat minor, played by Leif Uwe Andsnes. Wonderfully played, too. Didn't you think that sudden change of key hit one between the shoulders?
Oh, completely. It's that beautiful double-edged sword, I think, that within mourning there is also celebration. That's the jolt for me, absolutely.
We've heard, Lucien Umsamati, about the challenges you faced as a young actor trying to make a living. If you were advising other young actors listening, is it a question of believe in yourself and keep going?
That would be one thing, but I would say the flip side to that is continue to sharpen your axe. Don't sit idly by. You don't get better by sitting by the phone. You don't get better by praying on your knees for things to get better. You get better by getting up and doing it. And you do not need to be on the Olivier stage or, you know, in the grandest, greatest Hollywood production there is to practice your craft, to get better at what you do. The world is full of community halls, performance spaces all over the place that are waiting for you to get up and do it, because that is when it happens, and that's how you get better. That's how I got better. And so my provocation and my challenge is get up and do it. Stop making excuses, get up and do it, find a way, because there is someone who's already doing it whilst you're sitting, contemplating and thinking and feeling. And that person will probably employ you, and you'll probably get very annoyed and become the Salieri to their Mozart. So before that happens, get up and do it, say I.
Yeah. Well, finally, Lucien, what have you chosen to, as it were, play us out on?
Well, this fine gentleman for me easily sits in amongst his forebears in the classical and contemporary world, Mr. Benjamin Clementine, who for me is a unique, a beautiful, mysterious, amazing, crazy, soul-filled, musically inspired teller of stories. And I remember one day singing this song, humming it to myself, mangling the lyrics as one does when one is making one's coffee and vacuuming. And my daughter hearing me singing, howling with laughter because she didn't believe that that was a real song. And then I played it for her and she howled with even more laughter. And we have remained fans of the song and of Mr. Clementine ever since.
Well, Lucien Umsamati, thank you very much as we partake of St. Clementine on Tea and Croissant, composed and performed by Benjamin Clementine.
The pleasure was all mine, sir. Thank you very much.
Where is your son? Where did he go?
Clementine is on Tea and Croissant. Clementine is on Tea and Croissant.
Where is your son? Where did he go?
Miss Clementine is on Tea and Croissant. Miss Clementine is on Tea and Croissant. Leave him alone.
Sweet sugar stranger, where did he go?
Miss Clementine is on Tea and Croissant. Miss Clementine is on Tea and Croissant. Leave him alone.
Sweet sugar stranger, where did he go?
Miss Clementine wants no more problems. Clementine wants no more problems. This Clementine is enjoying his tea and croissants. This Clementine is on his tea and croissants today. This Clementine is on his tea and croissants. This Clementine is on his tea and croissants. This Clementine wants no more problems. This Clementine wants no more problems. This Clementine is busy enjoying his tea and croissants. This Clementine is on his tea and croissants.
Where is your son? Where did he go? Where is your son? Where did he go? Sweet sugar stranger, where did he go?
Little Clementine knows where he is now. Little Clementine knows where he is now. There's no need to worry about him. There's no need to worry about him. croissants. This Clementine is drawing his tea and croissants. Little Clementine is drawing his tea and croissants. Little Clementine is enjoying his tea and croissants today.
St. Clementine on Tea and Croissant, composed and performed by Benjamin Clementine, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the actor Lucien Umsamati. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's guest will be the Academy Award-winning costume designer, Jenny Bevan.
Hello, I'm Clive Myrie. I've been in some difficult and dangerous situations in my career as a journalist, and music has often helped me through the bad times.
I feel like music conveys emotion in a way that nothing else does.
In series two of Music on the Frontline, I'm speaking with more colleagues about the power and impact that music has had on their lives whilst working in some of the toughest places in the world.
The third movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, it's to me about loss, anguish, a frenzied madness, which is the madness we see in war.
Join me, Clive Myrie, for Music Matters, Music on the Frontline. Available now on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3 on FM, on digital and on your smart speaker. It's 1:30 and time to join Sarah Moore-Peach for her Sunday afternoon musical journey.
Hello and welcome to Radio 3's Music Map. Each time we pick a single piece of classical music and go digging around to find connected sounds, building a map that leads us towards our endpoint. And let me tell you, a great deal of rigorous research goes into it, which is just as well, because today's destination is the Academic Festival Overture by Johannes Brahms. Maybe I was exaggerating the extent of my own research. Actually, quite a lot of what we throw up in our music maps is serendipitous and intuitive. And when it comes to this destination piece, that is no bad thing, because despite the fact that Brahms' music is often misunderstood as being very academic in style, this piece is a lot of fun, based almost entirely on drinking songs.
Poiché